Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Hello, listeners. This is Dr. Doris, and I'm really excited about tonight's guest, Raja Marhaba. She is the founder of the Jonathan Foundation. That's part of the special education system that doesn't directly apply to brain injuries, but has a lot of peripheral connections. And so I'm really excited to talk to her tonight to find out about advocacy and resources that people may be searching for. So just a little introduction about her. She has won tremendous number of awards. I mean, I'm sitting here talking to a celebrity. I mean, I'm just looking at the resume she sent me, and she's done a little bit of everything. And basically, she put it all together, and she has a certificate from the Paralegal Studies of the University of California with a concentration in litigation of corporations. So that way she knows how to set up the organization properly and make sure it's working. And making sure it's working is pretty darn important for this type of organization. Basically, it's a nonprofit organization for children with learning disabilities. And she has been recognized for the San Fernando Valley Business Journal about 20 years ago for learning the hard way. That's what the special education problem is about. How do we find ways to fit these students in our society, in our schools, in our program, and specifically children in foster care and from the probation system? How do we fit them in seamlessly? Well, Raja will tell us a little bit about that tonight, and I want to introduce Raja so she can introduce herself and the Jonathan Foundation to our listeners. Hello there, Raja.
Thank you so much, Dr. Doran. My name is Raja Marhaba, and I'm a special education advocate. I founded the nonprofit for children with special needs. It's the Jonathan Foundation for Children with Learning Disabilities, but it goes beyond learning disabilities. When I started my advocacy in 2001, a lot of the families that I was advocating for had more challenges with their children than just learning disabilities. A lot of them had Asperger's, autism, Down syndrome, developmental delay, traumatic brain injury, and the list goes on. Everything and anything on the spectrum, even medical diagnosis with coexisting ADHD, anxiety, depression. I realized back then that I could not focus only on learning disabilities, although the Jonathan Foundation was formed because of my own two struggles with my own two children, specifically Jonathan, who's my younger son, it started with him because he's severely dyslexic and has learning disabilities and struggled with amblyopia, OCD, extremely hyper ADHD. He's considered twice exceptional, highly gifted and learning disabled. It started with him because he was easily diagnosed. His brother Omar was also, I didn't find out there was something going on with him until the fourth grade, but he was inattentive with ADHD. He dealt with depression. He dealt with vocabulary and writing deficits. So each child, and he also had high IQ. So both kids were twice exceptional, highly gifted, but learning disabled. And so you say, how could that be? On the exterior, these individuals, not limited to my own two children, any individual you walk on and you see in the streets and you pass them by, you don't know what's happening within the confinements of the brain, and that's where everything starts. And on the exterior, they appear to be looking great, but in the interior, you don't know what struggles they're going through. And so you think they're okay, but they're not. And so I learned quite a lot from my own hands-on experience with my own two children trying to navigate, in my opinion, the national broken special education system.
Mm-hmm. So how
you have
are
any
your
questions?
Children doing education-wise?
Today, this started, my advocacy for them started 25 years ago. As we speak, Jonathan is 30 and Omar is 32. Jonathan is a realtor, successful, and Omar is gifted in technology and successful. What I had gone through with the school system in California, I was a novice parent 25 years ago, and I had no idea how to navigate the system, and I did not know what was going on with both my sons. And there was, back then, we didn't have Google, we didn't have resources. The school districts would not share information of other parents that have children with special needs so you can network. So they didn't even allow that. And so just to go backwards, it was a big struggle from 25 years ago navigating the system to get the services they need to get to where they are today. Today, they're in a much better place, but my family struggled and suffered so much because we ended up initiating a due process against the second largest school district in the nation, where there was 4 due process for each child. And it took about 8 years to get through the whole process because every 2 years there are violations in, it's called an individual education plan. It is a legal contract between the school district and the student to provide services, whether it's occupational therapy or speech and language or educational therapy. That IEP, the individual education plan, is the vehicle that allows the school districts to provide services for the children. Well, not every school district operates the right way, and not every school district staff is educated and trained in special education. So violations are typical in these IEPs, and so the statute of limitation is every 2 years. So if violations happen in 1 year and then the next year and the parent sees the regression and the student, the child's not progressing or doing well, then that parent can actually take that IEP to an attorney and initiate a due process against the school district to hold them accountable and make them provide the services that the child needs in order to access grade level curriculum within the school environment.
Wow. Wow.
It's been a struggle. We ended up going, the school district took us to Ninth Circuit Federal Court because I was one of those parents that just would not go away. And I had no idea. Well, I had no idea back then because, remember, I was a novice mom, and I trusted the school system. I trusted the educators. Whatever they said, I did. Whatever recommendations came from them for both my sons, I obliged. I did. I was just, you know, I'm not the educator. They are. So I believed in them. And as time went on and I started to realize that the reason the national broken special education system is the way it is it's all about money and politics and budgeting. And I did not know that as a novice mom 25 years ago, and I learned that the hard way as we went forward year after year, because services were not being provided, the IEP was being violated, my children were regressing. And by the time I initiated all these lawsuits, I had no idea what I stepped into and got myself and my family involved. I didn't know. And so I became the quote-unquote paralegal for the attorneys because I was trying to save money. The retainers are expensive. And then I went through two or three different attorneys because I learned that not every attorney has the best interest of the child, and every attorney has a different agenda, and you need to find the attorney that really sincerely cares about the child and the outcome of the child, and those attorneys are out there. But then you have attorneys that have a different plan, a different reason why they're in the business. And so in my opinion, when I was going through the process, because of the horrific devastation that my family endured financially and emotionally, and my children were placed on hold until we won all the lawsuits, is that they pay the highest price possible for free and appropriate public education, and our children became my children, my opinion, became commodities to the powers above, because the child, you have to have a case in order for an attorney to take the case, in order to go to the school district and litigate the case, to win the case, to get the money. Some attorneys really care and truly love the children and do it in the best interest of the children, and some attorneys have a whole other agenda, and I experienced both. And I didn't believe in the system. I'm talking 25 years ago, because I was taken, I was hurt, my marriage was on the rocks, my kids were on hold, the attorneys wanted money, you know, $5,000 retainer, $10,000 retainer, we're going to hearing, I need another $20,000. My husband at the time was trying to build a construction business, and I was impeding him because whatever money he needed for capital for the business, I was taken away and given to the attorneys to fight for my sons.
Uh-huh.
And it was very, very difficult. Very, very difficult to do.
Wow.
The entire process was when you're a mom and you have children that have special needs, and even if you're a dad, because I mean, there are dads out there that really want the best for their children, and sometimes one parent, like me, I only saw red and went after, you know, I went after the throat. I went straight to whatever it took to get for my kids. And one parent, another, the significant other might say, hey, we can't afford this. We don't have the money. Assessments were very expensive. You would have, for example, Jonathan, talking 25 years ago, maybe a speech and language was about $1,500, assistive technology, another $1,500. A psychoeducational assessment would be about $4,000. It adds up, and for the lawyers to have the evidence that they needed to dispute and go up against the school system, they needed current data, and these assessments provided current data. So over and above the fees for the attorneys, the retainers, the hearings, the everything that I had to pay for them, I was told that I had to also pay for all these other assessments, and for one child, it can easily increase from $1,500 to $15,000 or $20,000 a child on top of the legal fees to fight. And now you just have the assessments. We haven't even touched the therapy, or we haven't even touched what they refer to as a non-public school, which is a private Ivy League school specifically for learning disabilities, which is what both my sons attended, that can range anywhere from back then $11,000 to $50,000 a year for these schools, because they're no more than 10 or 15 students per classroom, two teachers in the classroom. They have more concentrated programs. So, and this is what my sons needed to progress. So, but you as a parent have to put the money up in order to give evidence for the attorneys? And how many parents have this kind of money? I did not have this kind of money. I'm a middle-class mom. For me, I ended up selling a house. I owned property. And how many parents own property that they can sell a house and get some equity and pay whatever they can? I was getting bills of $300,000-$400,000 bills from the attorneys. And I'm still paying out of pocket for assessments and therapies. And my marriage was going to hell. My kids were on hold. It was a horrible, horrible 8-year process to get through this, but I've learned so much from the system, about the system. I've saw through the eyes of my own children who taught me and showed me what I could not see if they weren't part of this entire journey that my family embarked upon.
Wow. Wow. Tell me a little bit more about the Jonathan Foundation.
It was even before we settled and we won the lawsuits against the district. Before that, I used to take Jonathan for educational therapy, and this office, not only did they have educational therapy, they had psychology and psychiatrists and all different types of therapies in there. And so Jonathan is having his therapy, and I'm sitting in the waiting room, and the psychologist comes out, calls me into her room, and she says, "Why don't you sit, let's have a talk." So we started talking, and about 15, 20 minutes passed, and we're having a conversation, and it finally dawned on me that the psychologist was giving me therapy because I was so broken. I was broken. I'm a woman of faith. I actually went to church one day, and I went to the tabernacle, and I went on my knees and I prayed, and I actually told God, "Please, I'll make a pact with you. Help me get through this process with my children, and you can have my soul. Like, just help me with my children."
Wow.
And I'm in the room with the psychologist, and she's giving me therapy. And I stopped her, and I said to her, "You're giving me therapy right now, right?" And she goes, "Yes." And I go, why are you giving me therapy?" And she goes, "Because you look like you need it. You look like you're broken." I said, "I am so broken." And I told her about the church. I was just ready to raise my hands. I mean, you have a 7-digit lawsuit over your head as a mom. You have a husband that doesn't want the marriage, doesn't know what to do anymore. The business is failing. You have 2 children that have been on hold for many years with no services coming to them, no help, no therapy, no nothing. And you're looking at yourself and you're knee-deep, excuse my French, into the shit. And you're saying, where do I go from here? And back then, there was no Google. There was no networking. There was no socializing with other parents with special needs. And see, I felt all alone. And here's the psychologist telling me, you need help. And then in talking to her, I said to her, "I'm so angry at the system. I'm so pissed off of everything that's been happening to my family, and I want to do something about it." She goes, "So do something about it." I said, "I want to start a nonprofit, and I want to help families." She goes, "So then do that. If that's what you feel you want to do, do that." And that's how the foundation came to be. I actually went and I took her advice, and I started a nonprofit. And back then, I had no idea that a nonprofit is technically a business, only it's not-for-profit versus a for-profit business. And I didn't understand that concept of it, although I co-owned a construction company with my ex-husband now, and it took, the toll was excruciating for my family to get through this process. But it was, I think everything that happens in life happens for a reason, and our faith takes us to what our destiny is in life, whatever that is, whatever trials and tribulations and adversity that one endures, there's a reason for this. There really is a reason. And if not for my sons being born the way they were born, and for me crying endless nights in the middle of the night, sitting at the edge of my son's bed wondering, what am I going to do? How to help this child? I didn't know how to help this child. It is that journey that empowered me and compelled me to create a nonprofit. And we just started, you know, what I wanted to do is raise money for assessments, because without assessments, really good assessments by highly credentialed neuropsychologists and psychologists to administer a psychoeducational report. And the psychoeducational report, the testing consists of cognitive, social, emotional, behavioral, and academic domains that they test in these areas. And I go back to how the brain is wired. Our trademark is, how are you wired? And you're in a field for traumatic brain injury, and you understand this. And everything happens within the confinements of the brain. If there's something going on within the rest of the body, it's triggered because something's going on in the brain. So in order to figure out who the child is and what's happening with the child from within, these assessments need to be administered, and they should be administered by highly credentialed individuals who are experienced in this area to get a true reading of what's happening with the child.
Yes, that's
true. So we ended up, what I wanted to do in 2014, we had our first fundraiser, although the foundation was formed in 2001, but that was formed because I had a desire to want to do something, but I did not have all the connections, the know-hows, and how to put it all together, and I was still in the middle of due process for both sons. And so it was up until everything was finished with the lawsuits and settled, and I was able to breathe again. In 2014, I put a board together, and we held our first fundraiser. And I decided that I want the money to go towards assessments, because without these assessments, the lawyers are at a disadvantage, because all the lawyers have from with them to litigate against the school district is the assessments that the school districts conduct on the children. And some are good and some are not good. So if a lawyer is going to litigate to get services, because that's the whole reason for litigation, is to get the services for the child that the school district failed to provide in the IEP itself, then that lawyer needs a really good comprehensive assessment that spells out everything that's going and that can rebuttal what the school district's assessments say or don't say. And the assessments are the vehicles that drive the IEPs. So the way the process works, a child gets assessed, whatever the recommendations of the assessor is, gets incorporated into the IEP and becomes program for the student. So if you have an assessment that is not comprehensive, then you're not going to have a good IEP if that assessment does not stipulate everything that's going on with the child and the data is not accurate. So you're going to have inaccurate data in the IEP versus accurate data in the IEP. So if you have inaccurate data in the IEP, then you're not going to have a functioning IEP to benefit the student.
That's true. So how do you find these people who assess the child?
Well, the school districts have in-house clinical psychologists and psychologists. So they have them. They're already paid for by the district. I have throughout the years created relationships with various different assessors, and so it depends what area the families are in, whether it's in another state or in California. It's word of mouth, and it's a list of assessors, especially for California, because I'm located in California, that I'm comfortable with, or I can call an assessor that I know very well and say, hey, do you know somebody who's, I don't know, in Santa Barbara or somebody in San Diego, because that's where the families are. And so it's just a matter of a couple of phone calls to get the right assessors in those areas to match that assessor with the student. And in Los Angeles, I have a list of assessors that I've been working with for years. And if it's a student that's out of state, I would do the same thing. I would go into that state. They have also, I'm not sure, that it's rightslaw.com. And Rights Law has an entire list of every advocate, psychologist, attorney in a national level. So you can tap into the Rights Law link, the website, and you can search for any attorney assessor that you need. And it's just a matter of doing your due diligence and asking for the CV and asking for recommendations and commendations from other parents about that particular assessor or attorney, so that you know if that's somebody that you, that a parent wants to work with. So I highly stress on, you know, doing your due diligence, because for me, 25 years ago, when I went from two or three different attorneys to find an attorney that understood my case, I was novice and I didn't ask the right questions to the attorneys. I didn't, I said I was just such a desperate mom that needed help. And these attorneys, you know, you hear the word attorney, oh, so they're credentialed, they know what they're doing, and so you go work with them. But I learned the hard way that that's not the case all the time. So you really, you need to interview the attorney, interview the assessor, and find out who they are, how long they've been doing it, what's their specialty. Did they come from a different career and just transition to be a special education attorney? Maybe they were a corporate attorney, you know, for the past 5 years, and all of a sudden they're a special education attorney. I'm not saying they couldn't litigate. They can, because they're smart. They're attorneys. They pass the bar. So it's just a matter of understanding that industry. But there might be a more seasoned attorney that has been doing this for 10, 15 years and understands the industry very well. So people, always do your due diligence and do not be afraid to ask questions, because that's, if you don't ask, you don't know. So it's really important.
That's true. But some people don't even know the right questions to ask. They have no idea how to figure that out.
Correct. So my suggestion would be, ask them, number one, for their CV or their resume, and ask them for clients that they've worked with, and call the clients and ask the clients information about this person. Google them, go to their LinkedIn, see who they are, see, you know, read their history. Right now, because we have the internet available to us and all these search engines, it's easy to find out information about people. So don't limit it just from face value. Do more homework, and you know, ask people that have worked with these individuals, are they good? And you will find out. The families will find out. This one charged too much money, or that one was really good. This one was good, but we had this hiccup with this person. And then you just make an educated decision on who you want to go with and who you think might be the best. And it's not always the most expensive is the best. Sometimes you get really good assessors. I mean, I've had assessors that they charge $10,000 a psychoeducational or a neuropsychological assessment, and I've had assessors that charge $5,000 for the nonprofit, for the Jonathan's Foundation. I cannot afford to fund a $10,000 assessment, because I'm raising money, and these assessments range from $4,500 to $10,000, and there are those psychologists that are well worth that money. But for a nonprofit, I don't have that money. So I need to negotiate fees with the assessors so that I can put money towards more than one child, two or three or four children, to help them. And what we're doing is very different than a nonprofit who may have, and I mean this with the utmost respect, like you, a nonprofit might be able to raise, I don't know, $10,000 and purchase a whole bunch of school bags for the students and fill them up with a whole bunch of goodies and give them to them. What we do is very, very different. And that is a very needed item for families and children for the school bags to help them to get where they need to go in school and to feel good, and feel good about themselves. And I have a brand new book, and I have pencils and pens and whatever goodies they come in the school bag. It's really good because some of these children can't even afford that, and they don't have that, or they have a hand-me-down, or they have nothing at all or something very old. So it's very, very important. All I'm trying to say is what we do is just as important. Only I need to raise $5,000 for one assessment, where $5,000 can cover, I don't know, 500 children, you know, to give them the school bags with the goodies in them. So it's very difficult. It's a huge undertaking to do this. And when I started to do this, to think even about assessments, I didn't realize what a huge undertaking it is, because I have to work so hard with my board to raise a whole bunch of money to take care of a few children. And my dream is to take care of more than a few children. So it's necessary and needed. And if you were to ask special education attorneys, what is the most important item that you need for your case? I guarantee you 99.9% will say updated assessments. And it's not affordable for families out there. It wasn't affordable for me.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So the children require an assessment before they can be assessed, can figure out, the school can figure out where to put them.
Correct. Correct. Without the assessment is what really puts it all together. It brings it home. And then more than the assessments, in addition to the assessments, when families come to the Johnson Foundation for help, when we pay the assessors to assess a child, for example, Jane needed an assessment. Jane came to me, and I matched Jane up with Dr. Psychologist, and Dr. Psychologist took Jane in and did all the assessment. I've negotiated with Dr. Psychologist. Not only do I want you to assess Jane, I want you to provide a report, and the report is 30, 40 pages, based all information on whatever the psychologist found out about Jane, testing Jane. But I also want the psychologist to attend an IEP with the school district to defend their report and advocate for services for the child.
Mm-hmm.
So they become sort of an indirect advocate for the student, because now you have a highly credentialed psychologist that wrote a 30, 40-page report that really understands the student, spent lots of time with the student to put the report together, to get the results of the testing, and go to a meeting with the school district personnel and the families. And now you have equal fighting power, because you have a highly credentialed psychologist that can talk the same talk as a school district clinical psychologist. And that's powerful.
Yes. So I'm just wondering, I mean, these assessors, they spend their work time with various children finding out about them. How much time do they spend with each child?
Depends on how many tests are being administered. Sometimes a psychoeducational report, because remember, they're testing the cognitive, social, emotional, behavioral, and academic domains. And maybe some of those tests take a half hour, maybe an hour. And then you're dealing with any and all type of children on the spectrum. So you might have an extremely hyperactive child that cannot sit a half hour to take a test. You might have to do multiple sessions and to get the good reading for this child, depending on what the test is and depending what the publishers of the test instruct the assessor, because every test has its own criteria and guidelines according to the publisher and how it should be administered to the student. So it could be 5 hours, it could be 10 hours. It depends how complicated the student is, and is that student cooperative. Sometimes you have students with cognitive disabilities. And you have students that have high IQs. You have students that are very hyper. You have students that have developmental delay. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. And so every child is very different, and every child's brain is wired very differently. And it's like when you go to the school system, the school teaches reading one way to all students, but their brains are not all programmed and wired the same way.
Right. Yeah, like people ask me, what can I expect from this treatment? I don't know. Everyone's brain works differently. Tell me if anything happens. You know, because we are all wired differently.
Yep. So even though you say, Dr. Dorian, that the Jonathan Foundation is a little bit different than your talk show radio, indirectly, there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Because in my opinion, it all starts in the brain.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's where it all happens. And then it has a huge area to go through once it leaves the brain. And there's many potential interferences along the way.
Correct.
And who knows how it's going to end up.
It's difficult. It's not a simple task. I mean, in the beginning when you introduced me, you touched a little bit about the juveniles and the foster care system and the juveniles in the jail system. There are advocates and social workers out there that do what I do, what the foundation does, but not everybody understands everything about the process. And it is a process. So I advocate for Children of the Night. And Children of the Night, Lois Lee is the founder, phenomenal individual. I call her Saint Mother Teresa because she's actually taken children off the streets, rescued them from their pimps, and helped them to have a better life and rehabilitate them. And when she was doing this, she realized a lot of these children have IEPs. And so she reached out to me many years ago and asked for help. And so I advocate for Children of the Night with the ones that have IEPs and want to get reacclimated back into the school system and society. And so also I think about the juveniles in prison. You have lots of students that are in the prison system that they might have minor offenses. They might be on probation. They might have gotten into the wrong crowd. And then I think about it, well, how did they get into the wrong crowd? Were they the class clown? Were they having problems at home? Were they not paying attention because they're so smart, but because they're so smart and so hyper, they weren't able to focus? Maybe they have executive functioning deficits and they don't know. Maybe they were never identified. These children end up becoming victims of circumstance. Because if they get rejected in one environment, they tend to go to another environment, and sometimes that other environment is a bad environment, and they end up in juvenile. And I wholeheartedly believe that a lot of these children that are in juvenile, that maybe they don't want to be in juvenile. Maybe they had problems at home, or they had problems with the people that they met on the streets or in school. Maybe the teachers were not the right teachers for them. Sometimes you have incredible, wonderful teachers, and sometimes a teacher can say one negative word to a child, and that's it. It's hard for that child to recover from that word.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get into the prison systems and work with the police and have the school police work with, let's say, LAPD, and go back to the school when you see this juvenile, find out, do they have good report cards? Do they have bad report cards? Do they have an IEP? Have they been diagnosed? Have they not been diagnosed? And it takes effort from the mental health organizations, from the school police, from the LAPD, from nonprofits like the Jonathan Foundation, and to have a collaborative effort and go to you get the students that are in probation from the school, from the police, you get information from the school police of the school that go to the school to find out the history of this child. And then you put an advocate in the middle, you get mental health involved, and you find out what is going on with this child and what caused them to be in there. And then you ask the child, mostly these kids don't want to be in jail, they want out. They're misunderstood. Some of them are just at the wrong time at the wrong place, and they got deep into a situation that they can't get out of. And some of them can be rehabbed and some of them not. But why not try to save the ones that want to be saved? And why not give the ones that want to be saved a second chance in life and do something positive for society?
Yeah, that's a fantastic philosophy, because no one really pays attention to these people. They just think, oh, they're in prison, they must have done something bad. But
correct.
People don't understand that
they
end up there, not because of what they choose, but because they don't know how to choose.
Correct. Correct. And some of them have great parents and the kids are in probation. And the parents says, how did this happen to my child? And some of them are just, they end up with the wrong crowd because of whatever's going on within them or whatever's been happening in the environment that they've been subjected to that causes them to do that. We all want to be loved. We all want people to want us. When you're a teenager and you're not loved and you're rejected, you're going to turn to the bad environment, because the bad environment is going to show you how beautiful it is until you get deep into it, and then you realize, oh my God, what did I do? And then you have parents that are loving and caring, and they want to save their child, but their child crossed over. So, but you need a village, a team of people to come together and try to save this one child. And I think this one child is worth saving, in juvenile or not. I mean, we're going and I'm advocating for families in the school district that are not on probation. And so why not go into the prisons and get the ones that can be saved, the ones that want to be saved, that want another chance in life?
Yeah, because they're young enough, they'll be able to do something with it.
Correct. And as long as they're juveniles, once they turn legal, and it's before they get legal, is the key to do it all, so that there doesn't go on their record officially forever.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Or not, well, many of the older people in prison, too, turns out.
Correct.
Because of the learning disabilities.
Absolutely. Well, that's how it kind of starts. That's where it stems. It's an unidentified disability, whether it's auditory processing, whether it's executive functioning, ADHD, a learning disability. A learning disability can be dysgraphia, which is writing, dyscalculia, which is math. It could be dyslexia, which is reading. It could be anything, but the key is it's the invisible disability, because you cannot see it on the exterior of the individual.
Right.
So.
Right.
And how do you identify that? You train the police about it, and the police are, you know, they're paid to do a job to serve and protect. They're not paid to understand mental health. They're not paid to understand how to identify a special education child, but they should have some knowledge, because sometimes you have students that are hard of hearing and they might be in a bad situation and there might be a police there and he might yell at the student, but he can't hear the police and the police doesn't know that the student can't hear him, right? They're both innocent, the police and the student. They don't know. So, and then you end up, the student ends up in a lot of trouble until later on you find out, okay, the student cannot hear. But that's a disability in and of itself. And some people say maybe that's an ability. But how do you identify that publicly? It's very difficult because it's hidden. Unless you're trained and exposed to it and understand it, whether you're a teacher, a parent, or a police officer, you're not going to really understand these children.
Yeah, the individuals, because each one's different.
Yep, and everybody has a different challenge. And everybody could be less or more complicated.
How big is the Jonathan Foundation?
How big? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Well, we're a small nonprofit. I wish we were very big, but in order to make more of an impact, I'm sorry?
At the moment, you're small.
Yes. 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 For as small as we are, we've done a lot of great work for families. We've funded assessments. We've advocated for children. We've saved lives. We've had families. A recent one came to me a year ago. A student was 17 years old. Mom called me, said, my son's a runner. He's in residential placement. He's had, I don't know, 4 or 5 5150s. You know what a 5150 is? A 5150 is suicidal attempts or attempts to hurt themselves or others. It's not good. So, I mean, and we've managed to make an impact in that student's life. I ended up listening to the mom, and because the student was 17 going on 18 and going to be legal and he was in a residential placement, I ended up referring the parent to an attorney, and the attorney got kicked in and was able to provide the student with services and help the family out and literally save that student's life. So there's many different scenarios. Yeah, but it takes a village. You know, the Jonathan Foundation reaches out to people within our circle, our resource, our network, and we'll refer out and we'll provide resources. If family needs advocacy, and we'll provide advocacy, answer questions. Sometimes families call and they have an IEP the next day, and all they need is just one question to be answered to prepare for the IEP the next day in school. We'll do that too. That's not a problem. And on the website, there's a whole bunch of resources, and there's a resource page that families can tap into and get more help that way.
So what is your website? How do families get in touch with the Jonathan Foundation or you?
It's www.thejonathan, and it's J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N foundation.org, thejonathanfoundation.org. You go to the website and you can send an email. If you need an assessment, you can go apply for an assessment, a psychoeducational assessment as well. And I'm currently working on a book specifically it's going to be sort of a resource book. It's a parent survival guide to getting special education services. The name of the book is Unstoppable, and it's pretty much my journey, my special education journey throughout the years. And it's going to have amount of chapters, and in each chapter there'll be resources that are related to what was discussed in the chapter, and at the end of each chapter there'll be tips and information from me for the families, and there will be a website that families can go to and email to get questions answered and to get help and support. So that should be coming out within the next 2 or 3 months, at the tail end of getting the book ready for launch. So I think it's just a lot of networking, empowering families and parents, and getting to know the right people in the industry to reach out to for help.
Wow, very nice. So you must know all the people down in your area.
I know a lot of people in my area, and if there's a need that I'm not familiar with, it's just a matter of making phone calls to get that person connected with the right organization, with the right individual to get support for that person. It's I don't want to reinvent the wheel, and I don't need to do everything. It's not about reinventing the wheel. It's about sharing information. It's about empowering parents, even empowering the students. I can't tell you how many students came to me and I sit and talk to them, and I read the assessments, and I'm pretty savvy with the assessments because of the hell I've gone through with my own two children. I needed to know what the numbers meant. All the assessments, have a lot of verbiage, description that the assessor writes in there, and then there's a whole bunch of numbers, and I needed to know what the data means. And I was trained by my son's psychologist many years ago, because I asked her, what does this mean? What does that mean? And she would sit and explain it to me, because I needed to know how that relates to my own children. So she helped me, and then I went on and got educated and learned more about it. So it's really, really important to understand all this. And I'll sit with the students once I read the assessment and I understand the numbers, and I would actually start telling the student, this is what's going on with you. This is how your brain's wired, and this is, you're having problems with writing, and your challenge is math, and because I see it. And so the child is like, wow, you know all this, and that's true, and you're struggling here. And the child would say, yeah. And I'll talk to them from, 6, 7 years and above. Under that, they're too young. But I can explain to the parents what's happening with the children and help them better understand what the data and the reports mean. And I tell the students that I am your advocate. So whatever's bothering you in the school, tell me. I will go to the school. I will go to the IEP meetings, and I will be your voice. So I give a voice to the children that once upon a time didn't have a voice. And I empower the parents to be able to be independent, not codependent on me, because I look at life, We're here, put on this earth for a short period of time. I don't want any parent codependent on me because of my knowledge base. I want to share my knowledge base with the parents and empower them to be advocates for their own children. And if they have a question, then they can call me and I can coach them. But they should be the advocate for their children to go into the school district and be a voice for their children. If they need more support than that, I'm happy to do it. But it's, for me, it's not about making sure that the parents need me because I need to get paid from them or I need them dependent on me. It's not what it's all about. It's about empowering the parents to do what they need to do to be there for their children. And if they need guidance, they can call for guidance and they will have the guidance.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you find a student or a parent resistant to some of the things you're suggesting?
Resistance?
Yeah, they want to solve the problem, but they don't want to do it this way or that way.
That's a very good question. I was taught years ago in training, you have to meet the parents where they are. Since the parents are their legal guardian for the children. There's no way in hell I can force a parent to do what a parent does not want to do. I can't.
Right.
If parents want to make a difference in their child's life, I'm so happy to sit and talk with that parent and educate that parent so that they can make that impact for their children. And if a student does not want to get help, then that is difficult for me to help a student that doesn't want the help. I've had students that have come and I've literally sat hours talking to this one particular student. He had extreme high anxiety and he had a lot of behavioral issues in the classroom. And we went through a whole bunch of IEP meetings and assessments. But I found a way how to get to this student because he was very difficult. And you have to earn the trust of the student. You cannot keep dictating to the student what is right or wrong. The parents reprimand the student at home. Then the school teachers reprimand the student at school. So now you have a student that is non-collaborative and does not want to do what the student needs to do to progress. So what I did with this particular student, I asked the parents' permission because he was 11 years old. He was a minor. If I can have a chat with him one-on-one. And I went into a class, one of the offices for an administration. This was during school time. There was an issue, and I went there. And I sat with him, and I talked to him. And I asked him, why did you behave bad? Why did you do this? And he goes to me, I don't know. Why? Do you know you did wrong? He goes, yeah, I did wrong. And he was very candid and open and honest. And I was, wow. if you talk to them the right way and not attack them, they're more prone to open up and work with you. And
yeah.
Some of these students, you know, they do have their brains wired a certain way, so they might have a mental challenge, right? Depends what's going to come out from the assessments and what's been diagnosed. And so once you understand the diagnosis and you understand the assessments, then you understand what you're working with the child. The school district assessors cannot diagnose. They're not allowed to because they're not doctors. They're not allowed to diagnose. They cannot diagnose autism, Asperger's, learning disabilities. They can say autistic-like. No, yeah, they're not allowed to.
I didn't know
that. School district psychologists and assessors can say this child exhibits autistic-like characteristics, but they cannot say officially this child has autism. They're not allowed to. But the highly credentialed assessors at the Jonathan Foundation funds the assessments are allowed to provide a diagnosis. So the family gets a diagnosis. The family gets, 30, 40-page report, depending who's assessing and how complicated the student is. They get recommendations, and they get the assessor to go to an IEP meeting and say, hey, here's my findings, here's the diagnosis, here's the recommendations, and here's the services I feel the student needs to get. And what do it's facilitating and negotiating, because the school's only going to give what the school wants to give. But if you give them a private report, now they have to consider the report. And now you have a credentialed assessor in the room with the school district's assessor that talk the same language. So then it's easier. And if the school district's assessment agrees to a degree with what the private assessor, the highly credentialed assessor, found, then it's a very good chance that service that is in agreement with both school district and private will end up being a service for that student. So it makes a big difference. Knowledge is power. And if you get the right people in the right place and the right time, then you can get a lot further for the student.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Because, I mean, so you're saying that everyone within the special education system, all the students, have one of these IEPs?
Yes. If a student has to be made eligible to have an IEP, then it's almost privileged today. And I say that with a lot of respect, because it's not easy to have a student become eligible for an individual education plan, an IEP. So even if a student is unidentified as special education, that student will not have an IEP unless they get the assessment, go meeting with the school, and facilitate it and talk about and collaborate on what's going on with the student. So you talk to the teachers, you talk to the parents, or all the parents are part of this meeting. If there's an occupational therapy, if there was an assessment, that occupational therapist is going to be part of that meeting. If it's a speech and language therapist and there's a report, person's going to be part of that meeting. The psychologist will be part of that meeting. If there's any type of assessment that was done on the student, to find out what's going on with the student by the school district, all those assessors are going to be part of that one meeting. And if it's an initial meeting to see if the child is or is not eligible for special education, that's very intimidating for the parent, because the parent walks into a room at the school environment with anywhere from 5 to 10 teachers, paid personnel by the school, that each have a report that's been written and on the child, and they're going to tell the parent what's going on. So until you go through that process and you meet with the school and they say, okay, here's our findings, they could say, with all our findings, this child does not meet the criteria to become eligible for special education. Or they might say, we agree that he needs special education. Now we can talk about services. It can go either way. It's
mm-hmm.
not that simple.
I see. I didn't realize that all students within the special education system had one of these IEPs.
Yeah, it's federal. It's federal law. There's the Individual Disability Education Act, which is federal law. That law is what allows the school to provide an IEP to the for the children. And the school has an affirmative obligation to seek, identify, and assess any and all children with any and all disabilities to find out what's going on a national level. This is not local. And
okay.
If a family feels that a child might need special education services and they've never been identified by the school and have never been made eligible, that family should write an email or a letter in writing, because if it's not in writing, it never happened. And you request from the IEP coordinator or the principal or both, and you say, hey, my child is, dear principal or dear IEP coordinator, my child has been struggling in reading, he's been flipping the B's and the C's, and his fluency is very low, his report cards are failing. So you say, and I'm requesting that you provide my child with an assessment plan and hold an IEP. Once that letter goes to the school in writing asking for an assessment plan, the school district has 15 days in California. This might differ from state to state slightly. In California, for the school to provide the parent with an assessment plan, and the assessment plan pretty much says, this is an initial assessment for an IEP, and we're going to assess in all the areas, social, emotional, behavioral, cognitive, and academic. If the child happens to have autism and sensory, they might do an occupational therapy assessment and sensory. If the child has speech and language issues, that is apparent, right? So then they might do an additional speech and language assessment. So now you have an assessment plan for the five domains, social, emotional, cognitive, academic, and behavioral, and now you're adding occupational therapy and speech and language assessment also. So once the school gives the assessment plan to the parents, okay, the parents gave it to the school had 15 days to fill out the assessment plan, give it back to the parents. The parents now have to sign it and give it back to the school, and I usually tell parents, when you sign it on that same assessment plan you put on there, I want copies of any and all assessments in this assessment plan to be provided to me within 5 days prior to the IEP meeting. And the reason I suggest parents to do that is because many, many times the school districts do not always provide the reports. Remember, the psychoeducational might be 40 pages, the speech and language might be 10 pages. The occupational therapy might be 5 pages. It's a lot of reading for a family to get a day before the IEP or the day of the IEP. And then if that happens, the parent is at the mercy, again, of the school personnel to dictate to the parents what the reports say. And maybe there's inaccuracies in the reports and the parent has not had an opportunity to read the report to say, hey, this is wrong and you need to change this. And they have the right to say this. So I suggest for the families to write on the assessment plan, I want copies of all these reports 5 days before the IEP so that I can, as a parent, materially participate in the IEP as an educated parent. And
that's
so
long.
Then these are things that I've learned the hard way.
Uh-huh.
So I don't want parents to make my mistakes. I want parents to learn from me. That's the purpose of the foundation.
That's who I am as an individual. That is so important because I know, like, medical research articles, but a lot of times you read the summary, but that doesn't tell you what's in the article. Sometimes they summarize one aspect of it and totally leave out something else, which might be just as important.
100%. And then, you know, even when reading the reports and the data, the school districts always, there's within the average range, and I've learned within the average range is not a pinpointing exactly what's happening with a child, because we're saying it's within a range, right? But it's not the actual data that says this child is it within the average range on the high side or within the average range on the low side? And that will make a difference. And I think it's the same thing in the medical industry, right? When you go, you get blood work, they give you a range of numbers, and they say if it's greater than this number, even though if the number is 31 and your number is 30, you're okay because you're within the average range. But you're borderline, and maybe you're not within the average range.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And that's how these assessments are written by school districts. When you do, and also the school districts, even though they come up with data, they have something called standard scoring, and they have a bell curve. And it's really the shape of a bell. And in the center of the bell is 100. The mean for standard scoring is 100. And they say 15 points above 100 and 15 points below 100 is one standard deviation, meaning one below one grade level. So if you have a child that has an IQ of, I don't know, 135, but their reading ability is 67, so you have a child with an extremely high IQ, the average is 100, but the reading ability for this child is 67, way below the average. So that would indicate a potential learning disability in the area of reading. I'm just hypothetically saying
that.
So if the parents don't understand the bell curve and they don't understand the data, they're not going to understand the child. I tell you, my son Jonathan, which is the example I just gave you, 145 IQ, standard score, right? The mean is 100, and his reading ability was 67.
Wow.
25 years ago when I sat with a psychologist, and back then we used the words mentally retarded. Today we use intellectual disability, correct?
So yeah.
Back then, this psychologist sat me down and said to me, your son Jonathan is in the mentally retarded range in reading. And I says, oh, he doesn't look mentally retarded. He looks great from the exterior. And my heart broke. What are you telling me my son's mentally retarded? He doesn't look mentally retarded. Are you kidding me? It's the invisible disability. On the exterior, he looks completely different than how his brain is wired. And the psychologist said, your son is so smart that he can't read. And he can't read because he's severely dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you're going to find that out is if you do these tests. And these tests, they tell a story. Every test tells a story about a student.
Very interesting.
And when you take, in addition to the tests, you don't want to just say, okay, I'm only going to do the assessment and that's going to tell me everything about the child. You want to look at the report cards. You want to see if they're failing grades in the same area. So let's say Jonathan is severely dyslexic and the test said he's 67 mentally retarded range in reading ability. Let's go look at his report card. Reading, phonics, phonemic awareness, F. Gee, you know, there's a correlation here. Let's go talk to the teacher. Can he read? He can't read anything. He can't put three-letter words together. He doesn't know how to read cat and rat and dad and mom. His peers can. Okay, so now his reading is very poor. His phonemic awareness is very poor. His report cards are very poor. The standardized testing is very poor. We just told a story about my son, Jonathan. And what do you do now? Now you've identified what's going on with him. Now you can start coming up with a plan on how to help him. But if you don't do this and if you don't connect the dots, you will not know the whole story about this child. And this child has a story to tell. Without speaking a word, you're going to see it on the paperwork and you're going to hear it from the teachers. and you're going to see it at home as a parent. But the dots aren't connected until you put all this together.
So
and
once
then the light bulb comes
are on. Connected, once it is all put together, you
I'm sorry?
Can you make a huge difference?
I didn't catch the question. I'm sorry.
Once the dots are all connected together, can you
okay.
make a positive continuing difference with the way the student learns?
Absolutely. Once the dots
That's
are connected,
correct.
Now you know what's going on with the child. Now you go back to the IEP meeting in the school, you get all the assessments, and you say, this area he needs help in, this area he's deficit in. So then they come up with goals and objectives in the IEP itself to address that particular deficit.
Mm-hmm. Wow, pretty interesting. So it does, it takes a village.
it's not just me. You know, it's not just the teacher. And there are some incredible teachers out there that do wonderful work with the children. And there are some teachers out there that have no business teaching. My son Omar was bullied by his sixth grade teacher. Okay, that teacher has no business teaching if that teacher is going to bully an 11-year-old that used to come home with heart palpitations and panic attacks from school.
Oh,
he hates
wow.
school. Like this is uncalled for. It's disgusting. And then he had a teacher, a science teacher. Her name is Aviva. The best teacher that he's had that changed his life in middle school, even when his other teacher in social studies was bullying him.
Hmm.
So he also had another teacher that he wasn't doing well in computer class way back then, and he was gifted in computers, and she didn't see the gift that my son has in computers. Today, this kid makes in the six digits in the computer company without a college degree, only a high school diploma, refused to go to college because he was so bullied by his sixth grade teacher and has no faith in the education system.
Oh,
it is
wow.
The teachers, it is the teachers that can make or break a student, that can dim the light or can shine the light on that student, because words are so powerful. And our children are in a school environment even more than they are with us at our own home.
Yes, quite often. So does anyone work with, like your foundation, do you guys, or do you know of anybody who does work with, like these teachers who shouldn't be teaching, who bully the students, who don't know how to deal with students who have special needs?
It is difficult because we don't have control over the school system. When I initiated the lawsuit, Omar's case went to Ninth Circuit Federal Court, not Jonathan, and Jonathan was more severe than Omar. But Omar's case, it was an eligibility lawsuit. He had something called a 504 plan, which is provides accommodations versus services. Jonathan got services, Omar got accommodations. Omar needed services. The school denied him services. They didn't want to give him services.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up in Ninth Circuit Federal Court to get services for Omar. And during a 10-day hearing, our lawyers put my son, 11, 12, maybe he was 13 or 14 at the time, on the stand, and they said one word. I don't want to say the teacher's name. They said the teacher's name. My son broke down crying. They had to stop the hearing and take a break because he was so traumatized by the name of this teacher being mentioned in hearing.
Wow.
So my plea to the educators out there, if you're listening, be a positive impact on these children, not a negative impact. And I know there are hundreds of wonderful educators out there that are doing it for the children for the right reasons, because they believe in them, they want to see progress in them. I honor you and I thank you for your service. And it's the teachers that don't do the right thing are the ones that really hurt me, because my family's personally endured that pain from my son's middle school teacher.
Yes. Wow. That's major, because, yeah, I mean, you have a range in every profession and everything you do. There are people above the mean and people below the mean. And it just happens that way. It's like, yeah, you can't tell everyone, well, find a new job, get do something else. It's not that easy.
No, and I have to tell you, not every child is college bound, and not every child needs to go to college. Some children don't want college and they do well without college, and some children want college and they do well with college. So as a parent, when I was raising both my children, because I was raised to go to college and to become a success and get a good paying job and get benefits, this is how I was raised. Well, I have Omar and Jonathan, and Omar did not want to go to college, and Omar had his challenge in middle school, and Jonathan wanted to go to college because Jonathan wanted to prove everybody wrong that said he could not be a success and he would never go to college, and his teachers told him this when he was in elementary and middle and high school. Not, high school got better, but elementary and the beginning of middle school, he was told that he would never make it to college. And so that stuck in his brain, and he was determined to go to college, and he did go to college, and he dual enrolled in college and in high school at the same time and graduated with a 3.999 from a two-year college. And he's severely dyslexic and reads as a fifth grader and did this. So there's so much hope out there for all our children if we put them in the right environment with the appropriate services. They can be success. I don't see why not. And every child has a gift, and every child has a skill, and it's different for every one of those children.
Yes.
So tap into the gift, tap into the skill, and elaborate on it, monopolize on it, grow it, and do something with it that is going to make you a success. Why? Because it's your passion, and it's your skill, and if you fall in love with it, you will be a success.
Yes. Yes, that's so true. And you're right, that college is not for everyone. College is for some people, but there's apprenticeship programs. And people like, a friend of mine was an electrician, and the apprenticeship program, he made a ton of money and really enjoyed himself and did it well.
Yep. Yep. We forget there's blue-collar and white-collar workers. And in the school, we took away the wood shop, the mechanic shop, typing. I mean, back then, you used to have a word processing class. You don't even have that anymore. I mean, and right? We took the art. We took the creativity away. We took music away. Well, a lot of these classes that we took away from our children, well, maybe the children needed it because they're not going to go to Harvard and they're not going to be educated with the school books. Maybe they need hands-on. Everybody learns differently. Everybody has a different style. So when you take all these classes away and you have a student that is just can't sit still on a computer 8 hours a day to do work, can't do that. And some kids need to be in a mechanic shop, and they need to wrench on cars, and they need to do really well, and they're happy with it, but they're not happy with the paperwork. Jonathan has difficulty with reading, so he's a realtor. I help him in the real estate because I have my license. I help him, and then he has transaction coordinators, so he can pay someone to do the paperwork for him in the industry. But he's around, running around, he's a people person, he's talking to families, he's listing houses, he's doing open houses. He's not the kind of person that's going to sit still in front of a computer 8 hours a day. The blue-collar workers, the contractors, the mechanics, the arts and crafts. I mean, it's a whole different industry, and then you're cutting out the opportunities for all these individuals to reach the potential in their endeavors and their dreams, because we're saying, you know what, we don't have these classes to offer you. All you're going to do is you got to take this written class, and you got to go sit the criteria to get college, or you have to take all these courses, and vocational school isn't the way it used to be anymore. There's no training. It's gone.
Yeah.
What do you do with that population? What do you do with the blue-collar population? We're not all made the same in school to sit and learn.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, we see a lot of the blue-collar people in this office because my husband, before he went to chiropractic school and before he finished college, he was a steam fitter for, 20 years before he decided to go to college and get a degree and then go to chiropractic school. And he's a brilliant man. He just, his father was a steam fitter, so he became a steam fitter. And he loved it, but, later on he felt the need for an academic environment and be a chiropractor to these steam fitters. And it worked out perfectly for him. And so we have a connection with the whole blue-collar construction industry.
Yeah.
And a lot of people come and see us because of that connection. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, he knows all about it. He can tell stories about when he worked in the trades, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's a different life completely, but it's very satisfying to some people.
And they make money, and they're self-sufficient. I co-owned a construction company with my ex-husband for 36 years.
Yeah.
And it paid the bills. And then I realized how important contractors are, because I want to work in a nice, high-rise, plush, wonderful, beautiful office building, right? I want it clean, and I want it where I walk in and I say, oh my gosh, this is so beautiful and I work here. Well, guess what? Guess who built that for you? Guess who put you there? The carpet, the walls, the painting, the lighting. It's the contractors. It's the blue-collar workers, and we don't appreciate them because we look down on them because, they just take a hammer and drywall and put nails in the wall and like, big deal. It is a big deal. They have a talent that you don't have.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And they need to be able to use it, just like everyone needs to be able to use their particular talent.
Exactly. Exactly. We did an injustice when we took away all those classes from these children. We did a big injustice to our children, to the future.
Exactly, because you can't expect everyone to be like you are, because they're not.
No. Thank you. Thank you. 1,000%.
So it's truly amazing. It's like that we can even expect that. I mean, haven't we learned anything ourselves? Those of us supposedly know this information.
It's difficult out there. Life is very challenging. And the sad part is I started my special education journey 25 years ago advocating for my own two sons. 25 years later, Dr. Dorian, I'm still fighting the same fight for hundreds of more families. The same fight, the system has not changed.
I know. And it's like, you work a little bit and you can change a little part of it and eventually you can make a difference, but it does. It takes time.
It takes time. It's not a simple. Life is not simple. Children are born into this world. Some of them are born fighting. Some of them are born okay. So why not make life a little easier for the ones that are born fighting? And how about the parents? there's a tremendous amount of stress that these parents endure when they have a special education child. Maybe they have two or three of them. Maybe they don't have the money to support the services that are needed for their children. Maybe the stress between them causes a marriage breakup. Then you have a typical child that doesn't have special needs issues, right? That typical child's neglected because a special needs child gets all the attention, and the typical child feels unloved.
Yeah.
Now the parent has to learn how to love all the children equally, and I believe that is one of the most can do, because I had that within my own two children before I realized Omar Jr. had special education needs. I didn't find him out until the fourth grade, but Jonathan from pre-K, I knew there was something going on with him. So Jonathan took every ounce of my blood to raise, and I took Omar for granted, saying, oh, he's typical, he's fine. He was not fine. He was not typical. I did an injustice to my son, Omar, by focusing everything on Jonathan, because Jonathan was so obvious he needed help, that I neglected Omar. And Omar ran away from home at the age of 11 and was pissed off at the world. And I didn't realize that. And I went crazy looking for him, and I couldn't find him for 3 hours. And I just parked the car and cried my heart out. And 3 hours later, he's walking up the block, and he saw me crying. And he says, why are you crying? And I says, because I thought I lost you. I love you. And his, you know what his answer was to me? You mean you love me? 11-year-old, you mean you love me? And then I said, oh my God.
Wow.
I had no idea what I was doing to my son that I thought was typical until that happened. And he honestly thought that I did not love him. He had a 504 plan. I was fighting for him, but not as fiercely as Jonathan. Jonathan was IEP after IEP and 10, 15 people in the room and fighting the world for him. And I think, oh, I just needed accommodations and he's fine. He's typical. There's nothing that bad with him. But I was wrong. I was wrong.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, like, yeah, some children get overlooked because they're not out there causing trouble.
Correct. And he started to get with bad kids because he thought he was unloved. And I think of myself as being a good mom, a middle class mom, raising good children. And Omar was on the edge of going to the wrong people, making friends because he thinks mom didn't love him. Then I go back to the children in probation. Yeah. It's so difficult. I learned such a valuable lesson from Omar that day because I realized how important it is for a parent to love all the children equally. But how difficult is that to do as well?
How difficult, yes. Because, some need, more help than others, like in this IEP or whatever you want to call it, but like some are more obvious problems. I mean, all people go through stuff.
Correct. And then, we grow into adults, right? This happens when we're young. And now we're adults, and we still have the same challenges, but now we're learning how to cope with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of, it's just what shows you how important this early education is, because there was no such thing as special education for quote-unquote normal intelligence people when I was younger.
Yeah, you're right. There isn't. We're just...
Now things might be different. I don't know, but it wasn't when I was younger.
I don't think it was identified as much in my generation or even the generation prior to me. I think my children's generation is when I started to learn about it. And even then, I was clueless. It was just learn as you go.
Yeah.
Today, parents are very lucky because there's been trailblazers that open these doors and resources and case laws and impact in the special education industry that you can tap into to get help. Just Google special education, Google the words, and you'll get a whole bunch of resources on the internet when you do search engines on just those words. So we didn't have that, my generation, the generation before me. That was non-existent. Or, and if it was in existence, we did not know about it. It was very few people knew about it.
Yes, I mean, that's true. I mean, I think about my uncle. He's, you know, autistic. And he was never identified as such because he's in his 70s, 80s, you know?
Yep.
He was never identified. It was just always, oh, he's a weird one.
And then how cruel is that? How cruel is that to grow up not identified as autism and being told that he's a real weird one? It should not be that way. It should not be that way.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's like, oh my goodness. I mean, now, like when my friend was telling me she was a special education teacher, you know, my mind automatically went to all these people out there with anxiety disorders, ADHD, learning disabilities, not necessarily mentally deficient, but all these other things that add up and make things. I mean, we look at it very differently today than we did when I was growing up.
Yes. We all learn differently. We're all wired differently. There's not one person that's wired the same way as any other person. You can't teach us all the same way because we're going to learn different. I'm very visual. It's very hard for me if you want to describe something on the phone to me personally, and if it's too complicated for me to visualize it in my mind, I'm going to tell you I need you to draw it on me, or let's do a Zoom and, you know, share the screen and show me how to do it, and I'll get it. So how am I going to get it visually in class if the teacher is talking auditory? I will not understand, nor will I learn how to conceptualize what the teacher said auditory in my mind, because I'm going to have a hard time making a picture in my mind to conceptualize it so that I can understand it. If the teacher was to show the same item on the board with a visual, I just got it. I know it.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny. I mean, like my husband and I mean, we walk down the street and, you know, he will say, you know, like, who is that person? And I'll say, I don't know. What, you know? And they'll say, we met this person at such and such a place, but I don't remember, you know, her name. And I'll say, oh, that's so-and-so. You know, I won't recognize that I knew her, but when he tells me where we met before, I'll automatically be able to supply her name.
You make the connection.
We just think differently.
Now, it's true. Now, imagine having something like that in a classroom where you can have a visual, auditory, kinesthetic, whatever way that children learn, but have it in front of them on the board so that they get it. Because when a teacher teaches a student a certain only one way, the whole class isn't going to get it. You know, those students are highly intelligent and they're gifted and they can do it. That's no problem. But what about the children that are not that way? Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting. So now this, one question about something you said earlier. You were talking about the kids, the school district provides the resources. Well, how do kids, when they're told they need these assessments, is that paid for by the school?
Yes. If, remember I spoke earlier about an assessment plan that the mom, the parents, or the dad goes to the school and says, I want my child to have an IEP, to have an assessment plan, and they And once the parent puts it in writing and gives it to the school has 15 days to provide an assessment plan. Mm-hmm. All those tests, the psychoeducational test, the occupational therapy test I spoke of earlier, and the speech and language test is all administered by the school free of charge for the parents.
Wow. They're
mandated to do this. That's how it starts.
That's fantastic information, because there was certainly nothing like that when I was in school.
Yeah, me too.
Wow, we couldn't even afford home ec supplies when I was in school.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty neat. So the kids can get assessed for their IEPs, their individual IEPs, by the school. That's fantastic.
Correct. The schools are mandated to do this. They have federal funding that the government provides to the school that pays for this. There's a caveat to that is Individual Disability Education Act, IDEA, is not fully funded. So the schools, although they get federal funds to do this, to pay for this, the sad part is they're not fully funded. And because they're not fully funded, depending on the school and the principal and the administration, it takes away from special education, because sometimes they say, well, they don't have it in the budget. They can't afford or they can't give the service because it's not in the budget. The other side of that is the law stipulates if a child has a disability that's been identified, then you have to give service for that child. The law doesn't say if it's not in the budget, it's okay. So there's a problem. That's why it's the national broken special education system. Until the federal government fully funds the school districts to give them the federal funding that they need specifically for special education, we're going to continue to have a broken special education national system. That's just the way it is. And kids are going to fall through the cracks. Not every child is going to get the services and the placement that they need. And until the parents, or unless the parents have somebody that's savvy, that understands special education, whether it's an advocate, a psychologist, an attorney, and not every parent is savvy. Not every parent understands how to navigate the system. I was just very blessed that I need to know. Like I'm going to turn every stone to find out what's the answer under that stone to get some sort of resolve for my situation. That's just me. Yeah. But not every parent is me. So it's really difficult.
So the Jonathan Foundation, your children are out of school, but you still devote your time and energy to this.
Yes. My sons are out of school. My sons sit on the board of the Jonathan Foundation. They volunteer. If I'm advocating for a family and I see a family that might have a child that deals with depression or somebody that's dyslexic or somebody that's in special education that my kids might be able to relate to those students a lot better than the parent or me because we're the adults, then my sons would go and spend time with the student and talk to them. And I usually ask the parents' permission if they're minors. And 100% they say, we'd love for your sons to talk, because they walk the system, they understand the system, they struggled. All the challenges that the child is going through, whether it's a teacher that is non-collaborative or a learning disability or trying to understand why the brain is stuck in a gear, right? That's how I look at it. You know, your brain is stuck in a gear until we figure out everything that's going on in the brain. We cannot unstick it out of the gear, right? Because you need to understand what's happening so you can address it appropriately and get the right services in place to get it out of that gear so that your brain can open up and start progressing and functioning the way it's supposed to function, because everybody learns. It's just they have different pace. Some children learn a lot slower than others, and some excel. So I would throw my kids to these families and say, hey, can you talk to so-and-so? I have had a student that actually his dad brought him to my house, and he was having a lot of problems with him, and he almost called 5150 on him, and he was very depressed, and he came to my house. Mm-hmm. And when he did come to my house, he appeared to be fine, and I asked him how he's doing, and I said, and he told me he was depressed and he wasn't feeling well, but he was not suicidal at that time. He was not experiencing any bad thoughts. And so I asked my son Omar to go sit and talk to him for about an hour and calmed him down. And I'm not saying they're miracle workers. I'm saying it's just when children connect better to children than they do to adults, and especially children, my sons are adults now, but they walked this same process and the same system. They grew up in it, so they get it, and they can relate better to these students than I, because I did not go through the system growing up. I did not have all these challenges. My kids did, so they can relate better to these children.
Very nice. Very nice. So, tell me more about your book that you're writing with the resources. But first, I'm going to invite anyone who wants to ask a question. If please call in number 424-243-9540 and press the number 1. That's 424-243-9540 and press the number 1. That way I'll know that you have a question. Okay, now Raj, I was talking. Tell me more about this book of yours with the resources. What sort of resources? Like everything? Social, emotional?
Everything. This, I started writing this book 10 years ago, and it was supposed to be a memoir that includes my special education journey. And then I met a publisher and said, you know what's really needed? And this publisher ended up having special education children herself.
Uh-huh.
She said, what we need is a resource book and a hands-on experience by somebody that embarked and walked this whole journey. Because a lot of parents have questions but don't have answers. And so we ended up taking the personal part of it out, and we left it specifically my special education journey. And it goes into all my trials and tribulations and all the hardship that my family endured, and specific examples on and what happened with my children in classes, with teachers, with the lawsuit, everything in there. And it's broken up into chapters, and every chapter has a lesson. And there's resources. So there will be links in the chapters. It's going to be audio. It's going to be hard copy. And they're going to download it on a PDF also. So it's very easy to get a hold of, and it's going to be affordable for families. And it's going to have different links that have to do with advocacy websites, with legal websites, with the acronyms. Sometimes school districts, when you go in an IEP meeting, they throw SLP for specific SLI, specific language impairment, or specific learning disability, SLD, or ED, emotionally disturbed. So you have all these acronyms thrown at you, and you don't understand what they mean in the meeting. So there'll be a resource page for that. A whole bunch of the law, how to do the assessment, how to organize a binder, what tabs need to be in there so the parents can get all the documentation and tabulate it and put it in a binder so that when they go to these meetings, they can just flip. I mean, you can do it on a computer or you can do it on a hard copy. And you can put all the report cards in one tab, the standardized testing in one tab, assessments. You can easily just flip to those areas and be organized during the meeting so that you're better educated on what's happening for your child when these school personnel start talking about their findings about your child. And if there's a discrepancy, you can easily flip to a page or on your computer screen if you're computer savvy, organize it. And you can go, hey, this this report says this and it's contradicting with what you're saying, or 3 years ago my son or my daughter had this score and 3 years later that same score decreased, so does that mean my son or my daughter regressed and not progressed in that particular area? So yeah. It's going to be resources on how to organize themselves for IEP meetings, resources how to get information on certain diagnoses, on the process of the IEP, on a 504 plan, tips on whatever that chapter content is. There will be tips at the end of the chapter, my own personal comments and statements, and here's what happened to me, and here's what I did, and here's why I did it, because it's a story. It's my story. It happened. It's real. And all mm-hmm. I want to do is share my story for the families to learn from me, not make my mistakes, because I've made mistakes because I was a novice mom, but learn from me and do it the right way to get the services and the placements that's required for their children.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Sounds like a great resource.
I want it to be a book that you don't just read and put on the shelf. My vision of this book is my business card book, if you will, that is the encyclopedia for these parents that they're always going to be referring to for resources. That's going to be the one-stop shop in this book.
Yeah, that sounds just right, because things you aren't sure you need, all of a sudden you find out about it reading this. So I'm sure it will be very useful to parents in that situation.
Well, that's the whole key. And the other part for this book, I want it to reach low-income families where that they can't afford an advocate, they can't afford an attorney, but maybe they can get valuable information from the book. And the book
yes.
would be a nominal fee.
That's fantastic. Why don't you tell people again how to get in touch with you and the foundation?
You can go to the website, thejonathanfoundation.org, www.thejonathanfoundation.org, or you can email me at info@thejonathanfoundation.org, and that email is also on the website. You can email direct from the website.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm surprised your sons aren't around to help, you know, put their input into this show.
Well, Jonathan is just recovering from COVID. So he was not doing well. Yeah, he was down for the last 2 weeks. But maybe we do another one, and I will put Jonathan on, and parents can talk to him direct and get his experiences. That would be something that I'm sure he would be very happy to do, because he's extremely outspoken and happy to share.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll plan on that then. So do you have anything you'd like to close with?
What I'd like parents to know is that there is hope out there for every child with every type of diagnosis, ability. A lot of parents don't like the word disability, but no matter who you are, where you are, who your child is, there's always hope. And the key is to never give up, because I never gave up. And I have embedded that into my son's brains, never to give up, because it's once you give up, game over. So just keep steadfast forward and believe in your children.
Okay, thank you very much, Raj. It was pretty inspiring talking to you tonight about a subject that's not at all inspirational on the surface. But thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity and your time, and I appreciate your audience, and I hope that our conversation and the opportunity that you gave me makes a positive impact on some families where they have a benefit. So I really appreciate your time.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much, Raja, and good night.
Good night. Thank you so much.